So we'll start in the Mishnah. Hey Zion Omer Aleph. Amen.
Okay.
So the advantage of starting this year in the Mishnah is that, you know, we begin not jumping in the middle.
Correct.
In a very complex, long sugya. Now this Mishnah deals with the question of someone who sells, let's say, wine or oil to his friend. And when is the kinyan, when is the transaction complete? At what point is it irreversible? Neither the seller nor the buyer, the mocher, the lokeh, could be chos over him, could invalidate the kinyan, rescind their das. And also, when the another issue that this Mishnah is going to address is when the person sells these liquids, he sells them by, let's say, a barrel, and he pours the barrel into the utensil of the buyer, but there's always some residue of liquid left in the walls of the barrel. So at what point does the seller say, look, I poured in as much as I could, and whatever's left, you'll have to be meichel me. Hamocher yayin v'shemen. This Mishnah mentions wine and oil, not because it's coming to exclude, let's say, grains. The same principles will apply to grains. But what's unique about this case of yayin and shemen is that since it's liquids, the Mishnah is going to attach a discussion about how much he has to pour out of the barrel.
Wouldn't grains be different? Because grains wouldn't be a residue. Grains would not be...
Correct. And since there's no residue in the case of grains, it's dry. Therefore, the Mishnah doesn't mention it. But otherwise, the same rules that we're about to learn would apply to dry produce as well. And the Mishnah says the following. V'hukru o shehuzlu. There was an agreement made, and the mocher and the lokeach decided to go ahead with this transaction at a certain set price. But after the agreement was made, but before the kinyan was finalized, the value, the market value of the wine, let's say in this case, again it could be anything, went up or it went down. It appreciated or it depreciated. If it appreciated, then the seller wants out. He doesn't want to be bound to his original agreement because now he can make more of a profit and the kinyan wasn't effectuated yet. If the object went down in the market price, then the buyer wants to back out of the deal. Now the truth is that the question of either the buyer or the seller backing down is relevant even if the merchandise did not appreciate or depreciate it. The Mishnah just gives a case which is more regular, more common. Under what circumstances would it be relevant in most cases that the buyer or the seller would want to back down out of the deal? It's either because the value went up or the value went down. Otherwise, it would not really be relevant. Since they made the agreement, they're going to probably in all likelihood go through with the agreement. Why would they back down at the last minute? It must be because the market value has shifted. Now, there's a sugya in Bava Metzia on Daf Mem Tes that's really very relevant to this Mishnah. And that's the sugya of Misha Para. Misha Para means that sometimes, even though legally you're allowed to back down out of a deal, but once you made that commitment as an oral or verbal commitment to some other Jew that you will go ahead with this transaction, you're not allowed to back down on a moral level. And if you do so, and if you violate that rule, then you get what's called a Misha Para. That's kind of a whammy. Uh-huh. And the question is, how does this sugya relate to that sugya over there in Bava Metzia? In fact, there's a sheet of Tosfos, not here in Bava Basra, but there in Bava Metzia, that even if the value of the merchandise appreciated, nevertheless, since the seller made that commitment to the buyer that he would sell it at that price, he's not allowed to back down from the deal. Our Mishnah would reflect, according to all those who disagree with Tosfos, and maintain that if the value goes up, then there is a heter for chazor, and it's not a mishnah part. It's not a moral commitment. Our mishnah bedafka chose a case where it appreciated in value or it depreciated in value to tell us that they're allowed to back down out of the deal. Mm-hmm. My commitment, my oral commitment, is conditional. If I don't lose by living up to my commitment, we'll go through with the transaction. But if I'm going to lose, and whether it's the mocher who lost in the case where it appreciated or the lokeach who lost in a case where it depreciated, then according to most Rishonim against Tosfos, there's no mishapara, there's no moral commitment. I don't want to take a loss. And therefore the Mishnah wants to go ahead and tell me under what circumstances are you permitted to back down from the deal since the kinyan was not completed. And therefore the Mishnah Bedafka mentions these cases of huzlu or hukru, when it went up or it went down. In any event, now we get to the main question of the Mishnah. The Mishnah wants to address the issue, at what point is the kinyan finalized? And the Mishnah establishes, im ad shalom nismales hamida. The mocher and the lokeach agreed on a sale of a particular volume, and what happens is, the mocher now, let's say the volume was 10, and the mocher is now pouring the oil or the wine into the barrel of the buyer, that's the lokeach, until the point that that mida is the actual utensil that's used to measure it out, like we are measuring cups, until it reaches that point that it hits the number 10, the kinyan hasn't been finalized. Again, even though 99 out of 100, or I should say 9.9 out of 10, have been poured into the kli of the lokeach, nevertheless, until that very last 10 that completes the 10 has been poured into the kli of the lokeach, the kinyan is not finalized, and therefore either the mocher, the seller, or the lokeach have rights to back down out of the deal. The mocher again will back down because the market value has gone up, and the lokeach would want to back down out of the deal because the market value has gone down. But nismale samida, at the point in which the barrel is filled and the measurement reaches its fruition of 10, then no one could back down. Once it's nismale, it's full, and the entire measure has been passed on to the keli of the lokeach, then neither one of them can back down. That becomes a final transaction. And in order to appreciate this Mishnah, we'd really have to go back to Daf Peivav Amud Beis. I'll just give you the synopsis of the conclusion of that sugya. There are two ways you can sell things by measure. You can either say there'll be one sale on the entire measure, or you could say that that sale on the entire measure is really a sum total of many different fractions. So, for example, if he's selling 10 at 10, he's really selling 1 at 1. And our Mishnah is talking about a case where he's selling 10, and he's not agreeing to sell more than 10. It doesn't pay for the mocher to get involved in a sale for a small volume, because then he has to find so many buyers in order to get rid of his merchandise and sell it. So he agrees to sell this entire volume. He's not willing to agree to a sale on a fraction of that volume. So you don't prorate it, but rather you say that the kli has to reach its milui, and then when the full measure has been given over from the mocher to lokeach, means from the barrel of the mocher, poured into the barrel of the receptacle of the buyer, at that point the kinyan is clinched. Now, what the Mishnah has not yet addressed is the question of whose barrel is actually being used as the measure. We have presented the Mishnah, based on the Rashbam, as maintaining that the barrel and the receptacle belongs to the lokeach. And that makes a lot of sense, because we want the kinyan to be clinched when the merchandise goes out of the reshus of the mocher and enters into the reshus of the lokeach. In this case, the kli of the mocher is the chatzer, is the is the area that belongs to the mocher. The kli of the lokeach, respectively, is the area, the reshus, that belongs to the lokeach. And therefore, the Mishnah is presenting in the reisha the simplest case, where the material was given over from the mocher's kli into the lokeach's kli. But now the Mishnah wants to address a more complex case.
I'm just going to ask you, why can't you say Rubo Kukulo? That's quite a strong...
Rubo Kukulo only applies when there's a definite shear that the Torah has established. For example, if the Torah says that you have to drink a revius, then you can apply Rov revius. But here, the shear was a matter of convention, a matter of a decision between two human beings. There's no shear that was set by the Torah that you have to sell a minimum amount. And therefore, the mocher has a right to say, I agreed to sell X and nothing less than X. And therefore, it's got to be nismales amida. Again, now we go to the Sefer of the Mishnah, and the Mishnah addresses a more complicated case. The measuring kli, right, that's called the mida in the Lashon HaMishnah, belongs to a third party. Now, who is this third party? Why is he getting involved between a mocher and a lokeach? And the answer is he's called a sarsur. I think, again, you take a look in the English, I think a sarsur is called a middleman. It's usually either a wholesaler or a retailer. He really buys from someone and sells it for profit to someone else. So what he does is he offers his measuring kli, his measuring utensil, and it's now functioning as the intermediary, so to speak, between the mocher and the lokeach. Again, he's going to make a profit on this deal. So the mocher agrees to sell a certain measurement at a certain price. The sarsur presents his kli, and this kli, which is again called a mida, let's not forget that, is going to be used in a double capacity, in a twofold functional way. Number one, it's going to be used to measure out from the mocher's perspective exactly how much wine or oil he's willing to sell, meaning he's agreed on 10, so now we have to measure out 10. Call it lugim. Lugim is a measure of liquids. But it's also functioning on behalf of the lokeach, which means that once that measure is reached, you've attained that 10, the mocher is happy, you know, he's committed to the sale, but we need that the lokeach make a kinyan and that the shemen or yain enter into his reshus, his domain. At that point, the kli now shifts over to the lokeach. Now, what do I mean the kli shifts to the lokeach? Don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that the sarsur, this middleman, actually is makna the kli. He needs that mita. You know, that mita, that kli is worth something. What he wants to do is he wants to rent it out, so to speak, that's called schirus, in order to clinch this kinyan so that the merchandise of the mocher is transferred over to the possession of the lokeach. He functions as that intermediary. And he's going to be paid for that. He's going to make a profit on the deal. So what he does is he rents out this kli to both the mocher and the lokeach. To the mocher for the purpose of measuring it out, to lokeach for purpose of receiving the merchandise, in this case the yayin or the shemen, into his kli to effectuate the kinyan. And it's a really cool thing that goes on over here, because the schirus, it goes through two stages. There's one split second in which the schirus shifts from the mocher over to lokeach. At what point? That's called nismale hamida. As soon as the measure is reached, the 10 lugim, you know, bingo, we hit that point. At that point, the kli shifts from the ownership of the mocher to the ownership of the lokeach. Again, when I say ownership, I'm using that term loosely. It's ownership in inverted commas. And what it really means is a renting situation. Now, the Mishnah is going to digress to a different issue, which is only relevant to the Mishnah because of the sarsur playing this role as the middleman. And this issue is going to be dinei nezikin, the laws of damages. What happens if this utensil, this midah, which is being offered by the sarasur in order to play this role from the mocher to lokeach, breaks, who's responsible for that breakage? So let's look at the Mishnah and see if we can analyze this question. Ve'im haya sarasur beinehem, if the kli that's being used to measure out the wine or the oil is being offered, being presented by the sarsur, he's lending it to the mocher and the lokeach in order to function as the intermediary and clinch this transaction. Nishbara hachavis, and now this midah, which is also called a chavis is a barrel, which is used for containing liquids, breaks. Nishbara la sarsur. The sarsur is going to suffer that loss. Meaning, even if the kli breaks before it hits the number 10, in which case he was lending it to the mocher for the purpose of the mocher using it to measure out his wine, nevertheless the mocher is not going to be responsible. I'll read to you the translation. He says, Chayev l'shalim la-mocher, he has to pay the mocher. So there's a double loss here on the part of the sarsur. Number one, Nebuch, how do they say, shame, he's going to suffer the loss of this measuring kli because it broke and the mocher is not responsible. We have to understand why the mocher is not responsible. Number two, the wine was spilled out. Now, the lokech is not willing to pay the mocher since he didn't receive the merchandise. On the other hand, the mocher is going to suffer double jeopardy, because not only is the lokeach refusing to pay him because all his wine is spilled on the floor, but moreover, the mocher doesn't have the wine, he can't sell it to someone else. So in this case, the sarsur is going to suffer a double loss. He's going to lose the value of his midah, of this measurement. He's also going to have to pay the mocher to replace the yayin, because the mocher doesn't have payment for that yayin. And the reason for this, says the Rashbam, is a very fancy lumdus, as I call it, and that is that the sarsur actually is not just the intermediary between the mocher and the lokeach in the sense of joining them together to form one kinyan, but in truth, he becomes the owner of the wine. He never actually pays for that wine, because he's going to collect that payment from the lokeach and pass it on to the mocher. But in essence, what happens is that the sarsur makes a kinyan on the wine. For again, one split fraction of a second in the halachic universe, he is the proud owner of that wine. He receives payment from the lokeach, because once the sarsur offers the lokeach a kind of ownership, a quasi-ownership, we'll call it a she'elo or a schirus over this midah, the lokeach now becomes the owner and he has to pay for the wine. The payment is now transferred over to the sarsur. The sarsur picks up that money and hands it over to the mocher. So it's not just that he's gathering together two people, like they're, you know, in modern contemporary life, we have people who make their money by bringing a buyer and a seller together. Or, for example, you know, in startups and all this kind of stuff, you bring people together, you market or you advertise a certain merchandise of so-and-so, and you bring, through that marketing, you bring the buyer into the picture, and you get a commission that's paid from both the buyer and the seller, sometimes from the buyer and then the seller, whatever it might be. That's not what's happening here in the sarsur case. The sarsur actually becomes, for again, that moment of transaction, an owner over the wine. And therefore, as the owner of the wine, again, if assuming there was no negligence in the breaking of the kli, he, the sarsur, will have to suffer the loss of the wine. So Rav Osei, let's not ask too many questions about this piece of the Mishnah, because we'll have a whole sugya about that. Finally, the last part of the Mishnah discusses the following issue. And that is, when you pour liquids as we said before, there's always going to be some residue of liquid that remains in the walls of the barrel. Now the mocher has agreed to sell, bless you, 10 lugin. Yeah, but is it 10 lugin minus? Because there's going to be some loss of residue. At what point can the mocher say to lokeach, I did the best I could, I poured out all the wine and all the oil, and that's it? So the Mishnah says, no, he can't say that until the following point. V'chayav lahatif lo shalosh tipin. After he empties out the liquid content of the barrel into the midah, at that point he has to continue holding the barrel, tipping it over, until 3 extra drops of wine or oil fall into the receptacle of the lokeach. That's called shlosha tipin. Hirchina, if he poured he tipped over the barrel, umetzis, and yet there's still some residue of wine or oil left in the walls of the kli, hareyu shel mocher. At that point, there's something called yeush. Yeush means that, for our purposes, this is not a universal interpretation of yeush, but in this context, yeush means mechila. It means that the lokeach at this point said, look, Mr. Mocher, Mr. Sell, you did what you could. You stood there until the last 3 drops fell out. Whatever is left in residue in the walls of the kli, that's yours, soll sein gesund und stark. However, the Mishnah goes on and says, v'chenvani, but someone who's a professional chenvani, and he's constantly involved. It's not a one-time deal where he's selling a barrel of wine. You know, I can walk into the Beis Medrash and say, Rabbeisai, it was after, you know, Pesach, and I bought so much wine, I got a couple extra bottles, anybody willing to pay them off? Or the wheat, or the flour here, I don't know if they're still selling it here for 12 shekel from the challah bake of 6 months ago, but in any event, that's a one-time deal. Then you could ask the mocher to stand there like a dumbbell until he finally squeezes out those last 3 drops. But a chenvani is a very busy guy. His time is precious. You know, he's like the cab driver who, if you hold him up, he's going to lose another client. So, eino chayv lahatif sholosh tipin. He just has to empty the barrel into the barrel of the buyer, ungeendik tamaisa, and finito, that's sufficient. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda disagrees with the Tanakhama. And he's saying the following. The chenvani could also take a little extra time out to squeeze out those last 3 drops, as long as it's a weekday. But there's one day of the week which is very, very hassled, and that's Erev Shabbos. Is Erev Shabbos im Chashecha. On Friday afternoon, they made a takana, says Rabbi Yehuda, that this chenvani, because he's very, very busy, Erev Shabbos, you know, he sells his last barrel of wine an hour before Shabbos, let him get away with the 3 tipin, and he's off to take his shower and dress for Shabbos. But it comes out that this Mishnah, according to Rabbi Yehuda, is not willing to be lenient on behalf of the Chenvani, except for a special takana and Erev Shabbos. And this reminds me of a Mishnah in Masechta Shabbos, that you're allowed to run through the streets of a public thoroughfare on Erev Shabbos, because he's so torud, preparing for Shabbos. Which means that if I walk, run into your barrel, and your barrel breaks, I don't have to pay you damages, even though normally Adam would li Olam. This is takana that was made in order to allow people on Erev Shabbos to run around like crazy nuts. I always thought that maybe that takana should not apply in the summertime in certain parts of the world. Depends on which hemisphere you're in, because then Shabbos enters at a very late hour. But what I found in my life is that no matter when Shabbos starts, it's always to the last minute and beyond.
The reason about the 3 tipot is because if they didn't make it the 3 tipot, then people would start with the 6 tipot.
Correct. It's going to really get out of hand.
It would get out of hand.
Okay. Let's look at the Gemara now.
What's Im Chashecha?
Im Chashecha, he says over here, Somuch L'Chashecha, which means that the Gemara later on is going to have a suffix exactly what the nature of Rabbi Yehuda's kula is, allowing the chenvani im chashecha to get away with the 3 tipin. Okay, fine. The Gemara says the following. Ha mida deman. Who actually owns this measuring rod in the ratio of the Mishnah. Again, the Sefer clearly is owned by the Sarsur, but what about the ratio? And again, I gave you the final answer to this Gemara, but let's see how the Gemara arrives at that conclusion. Elam, if you'll tell me, Mida Dilokeach, if the wine is being poured into the measuring utensil of that's owned by the buyer, the Lokeach, is then I don't understand the Mishnah. Why? The Mishnah says, Ad Shalonis Males Mida Lamocher. What does it mean that until the last fraction of the 10 lugin that he sold is poured into the receptacle of Lokeach, the Lokeach is not Kona, and therefore the Mocher could back down if the value on the market of wine appreciated? It doesn't make any sense. Me the Lokechi. The Lokech has already taken 9/10, you know, 9 out of 10 lugim into his Rishus. At that point, he should make a kinyan. Why do we have to wait until the last lug of the 10 has entered into the receptacle of Lokech? He's already achieved the kinyan on 9/10, or for that matter, on 1/10, no matter what value it goes in. And here, the Rashbam quotes the previous Sugyan Daf Pei Vav, and he asks the question, well, what was the nature of the agreement? Did they agree to sell a certain measure, let's call it 10 lugim, at 10 sloim, or did he agree that each lug would be one sela? If the agreement was on one, it was on 10, but at a rate of one sela per lug, then even when the lokeach has a fraction, meaning he's already received in his receptacle one lug, so the kinyan will be chal, he'll be the proud owner of one lug of shemen, and he'll pay for that one sela. And that makes sense. Why do you wait until the 10th lug, the Mishnah says, and allow the mocher to back down from the deal? The deal should be clinched on one lug. Now, what the Gemara could have said at this point, says the Rashbam, is maybe that's not the case. He didn't add that extra word. The mocher didn't add that extra condition that I'm selling you one, each lug at a sela, meaning one sela per lug. He just simply said, I'm selling you 10 lugim at 10 sloim. That would certainly solve the problem of the Gemara. Why did the Gemara have to get so upset and complex about the Mishnah? Why did you say that the Mishnah is talking about a case in which the Mocher said the following words, okay, I'm selling you 10 lugim at 10 sloim, period. I'm not willing to sell you less than 10 lugim. As we said before, the Mocher doesn't want to run around and find 10 different buyers for each one lug. So the Rashbam says that what bothered the Gemara here is what's called stimas lashon ha-mishnah, meaning when the Mishnah doesn't qualify, then it means it's unqualified. If the Mishnah made an absolute statement that until the very last, you know, 9/10 of a lug was poured into the receptacle of Lokeach, the Mocher's rights to back down from the deal, it must mean that in all cases, that halacha reigns supreme. And the question is why? What about a case in which the Mocher added the words one lug at one sela? That's what bothers the Gemara. Therefore, the Gemara comes up with another suggestion. The Ella, maybe perhaps, Mida de Mocher. Maybe the owner of this measuring receptacle is the buyer. I'm sorry, is the seller, right? The Mocher. If that be the case, even Mishenismales Mida Lokeach, Mida the Mocher, who, why is it that up until the last lug that completes the 10 lugim, the Lokeach has rights to back down if the market price depreciated? Why is that so? The Kinyan, even after the last lug of the 10 lugim reached this receptacle, has not been clinched because the wine or the oil is in the barrel of whom? Of the seller, of the mocher. In other words, what we need in this case, now, again, the Rashbam points out that this Gemara is based on the assumption that Kalev Shalokeach Bershus Mocher Lokani, meaning that the lokeach has to take the merchandise into his kli and into his rishus. But it wouldn't make any sense for the kinyan to be chal in the kli of the mocher, because we have to worry about the possibility that the mocher's kli is not batel to the rishus. That was the discussion we had yesterday. And even though the Gemara, by the way, back on Daf Pei Vav Amud Aleph doesn't come to any final conclusion, but we always have the right to defend the position of the Mocher because he's a Muchzok in cases of Safek, and if I'm Motzi Mechavel of Araya. So we don't understand this Mishnah Mimarav Shach. Omar Rebbe Ila says that even in the Reish of this Mishnah, B'midas Sarsur, the measuring rod, the measuring receptacle, is owned by the Sarsur. And the Sarsur is going to lend it to the Mocher for purposes of measuring out the kli, measuring out the oil. And then as soon as we reach that full measurement, and the Mocher is now willing to sell it, at that point, the She'ela, the lending relationship, now shifts over to the Lokeach. So the Sarsur is the owner of this kli. Again, what happens if the kli breaks and the wine spills? That's going to be the safe of our Mishnah. So basically, he gives the kli, or lends the kli, over to the Mocher, up until the point where Nismale, it fills up, and then at that point, he lends it over to the Lokech. The Lokech now has a complete purchase and ownership over the wine. The Gemara is not happy with this. For Midiktani Seifa, and the Seifa says Vimhaya Sarsur Beinehem. If there was an intermediary, this middleman in between them, Nishba Chavis Nishba Sarsur Michlal. Michlal means I can deduce the Reisha Lav Sarsur Askinan. That the case in the Reisha is not where the kli was owned by the Sarsur, by this third party. The Gemara answers Reisha Mida below Sarsur. Seifa b'sarsur atzmo. The Reisha is talking about a case where the Sarsur is the owner of the kli. That's called Mida, right? Mida, but below Sarsur, which means that the Sarsur was not the one who was measuring on their behalf this merchandise. The Seifa is talking about a case where the Sarsur plays a double function. He's not just facilitating the kinyan between the Mocher and the Lokeach, but Sarsur Atzmo, that he himself is measuring it out. Now, who's doing the measuring? The one who's doing the measuring is the one who is involved in the actual transaction. The Sarsur could play one of two roles. Either he could just facilitate this relationship between the Mocher and the Lokeach, and he lends the measuring rod, the measuring receptacle to the Mocher, and then shifting, he lends it over to the Lokeach. That's going to be the Reisha. That's called, in the language of the Shas, Reisha Mida below Sarsur. I mean, he's not really playing the role as a Sarsur, he just owns the Mida, whereas the Seifa is the Sarsur Atzmo, he's playing this role of actually making a kin.
And the ratio, is he still paid a fee to lend his...
Yeah, for sure. He's going to make a commission on the deal because he's the one who brought them together. Mm-hmm. Now the Mishnah says, Hirchina u'meitzis harei shel mocher. If he tipped over the barrel and he squeezed out those last three drops, any residue of liquid in the walls of the kli of the mocher remains in the possession of the mocher. And the Gemara tells the following story: Ki solik Rabbi Lazar, when Rabbi Lazar came from Bavel up to Eretz Yisrael, solik means to go up, because Eretz Yisrael is considered gvoa mikol haratzos. Ashkechei leZeiri, he found Zeiri. Zeiri was one of the great talmidim of Rabbi Yochanan, and Rabbi Yochanan was located in Eretz Yisrael. So Rabbi Lazar turns to Zeiri, Mikan, is there anyone here in the land of Israel, Tana, who learned this Mishnah, the Asne Rav Midos, that learned the Mishnah that deals with Midos? Again, this Mishnah is a Mishnah earlier in the Masechta, and I need someone, that's what Rabbi Lazar says, to explain to me that Mishnah. Achvei, so everybody pointed, or I shouldn't say everybody pointed, I should say Zeiri pointed to Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Avdimi. Amalei, so Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Avdimi turns to Rabbi Lazar. He says, my kokashale, what problems, what difficulties do you find with the Mishnah of Midos? And Rabbi Lazar said to Rabbi Yitzchak, Disnan, the Mishnah says, Hirchina means when he tipped over the barrel that was being poured for the purpose of the kinyan, who mates it, and some residue collected, hareyu shel mocher, and it belongs to the mocher. And here we go on to Pesayin Omid Beis. Vasnan, but what about the Mishnah at the end of Masechta Trumas? The Mishnah there says that if you pour shemen or yayin of truma from one receptacle into another receptacle, then the law is that you have to be mativ an additional shalosh tipin, and at that point, muta lamali bo chulin. He can assume that anything he pours into this empty barrel, again, it's an empty barrel, but it still has residue, is chulin. Okay, now if after he tips the barrel that has truma in it, hirchina umitza, and now he sees that nevertheless, there's still some residue of shemen or yayin of truma in the walls of the barrel. Harezu truma. In such a case, he does have a responsibility to consider it truma. It's not chulin, and no one is allowed to partake of that except for a kohen. Again, if he went ahead and he poured chulin into that barrel, then we operate the laws of bittul. But to be mavatal truma is very difficult. So Rabbi Yitzchak turns to Rav Elazar and he says, what's your problem? You think that there's a contradiction between the Mishnah in Truma and our Mishnah in Bava Basra. The Mishnah in Bava Basra assumes that anything that's left in the barrel belongs to the Mocher after he tipped over and he inclined the thing and there, he squeezed out another three drops. But the Mishnah in Truma assumes that anything that's left, any residue in the walls of the original barrel of Truma is still Truma, and it doesn't have the status of Chulin. He says, Ha'itmar Allah, but what about the statement that was made with regard to our Mishnah? Omer Rabbi Avo, Mishum Yeish Bailim Naguba. The reason why the residue after the three drops belongs to the mocher is because of Yeish, that the lokeach, you know, he basically throws up his hands and he says, it's hefker, I don't need any more wine. I got whatever oil or whatever wine I needed it. And therefore he's mevater, he waives the rights to force the mocher to do more of a tircha and get out more wine residue. But in the case of truma, that logic doesn't apply because truma remains truma. Yeish is not going to change the status of truma, meaning even if the kohen is misyahish, nevertheless, the status of truma is retained. So let's explain the following. Truma has two dimensions to it. This is a very profound discussion, not for a daf yomi shiur, but otherwise we don't know what the heck is going on here. And that is, truma has one dimension in which it has been sanctified with kedushas truma, which means it's osul azarim, and in the second hand, it becomes momen hakohen. Again, that's also complicated. First it becomes moment of Shevet Kuhuna, and then it becomes moment of one particular coin, and how that happens is complicated. So here the Gemara says that although Yeish could help as far as the coin who poured out the wine from this barrel and any residue he might be Messiah on, but that doesn't undermine the status of the wine as Truma. It is Truma and it remains Truma. Yeish is not going to be Mafkia, the same Truma. Let's see if we can, in the next few minutes that we have, if we can possibly finish the Mishnah. Hachenvani eino chayev lahatif. Okay, the Mishnah says, according to the Chachamim, the Chenvani, who's so busy buying and selling, he was exempt from this extra tirch of standing there and pouring the barrel to get out the last three drops. Rabbi Yehuda said, that's not so. Even a Chenvani is required to pour those three drops, except for Erev. Erev Shabbos. Iboilu, the Gemara has a suffix. Rabbi Yehuda, when Rabbi Yehuda made his comment, again we should keep open the Mishnah, so we have Rabbi Yehuda's comment. And the language of Rabbi Yehuda is that the Erev Shabbos im Chashecha, Hachenvani Patur, is Aresha Koi Ulakula Odilma Asefa Koi Ulachumra. There are two ways of interpreting the words of Rabbi Yehuda. He might be referring to the Reisha of the Mishnah. The Reisha of the Mishnah establishes Chayov Lahatif Lo Shalosh Tipin, that there's an absolute obligation on the part of the Mocher to squeeze out the last three drops. Ula Kulin, Rabbi Yehuda is coming to be Mekil and to say the following, that a Mocher who's selling wine or oil, even if he's not a professional seller, it's our case of Motzei Pesach, where I'm selling you my leftover wine, he's potur, he's exempt from being mativ, sholosh tipin, on Erev Shabbos im Chashecha. In other words, when Rabbi Yehuda made this comment that there's a ptur on Erev Shabbos im Chashecha, is he talking about a chenvani, and he's addressing the exact case of the Tanakhama, or no, he's talking about a regular classical mocher, not a professional seller, and he's instituting this takana to alleviate the mocher of his responsibility of squeezing out three drops on Erev Shabbos, o dilma asefakoi. Or shall we interpret Rabbi Yehuda the way we understood Rabbi Yehuda originally when we presented the Mishnah? Ula Chumra, that Rabbi Yehuda is coming to be Machmir because he's addressing the case of the Chenvani, and he's saying that the Chachamim in our Mishnah alleviated the Chenvani of his responsibility of Hatofas Sholosh Tipin. Comes along, Rabbi Yehuda says, Nein, I refuse to accept that position. Even Chenvani is obligated to be Meitiv Sholosh Tipin, with the exception of Erev Shabbos Toshma. The Gemara says, I have a brisa from which I can derive the conclusion that Rabbi Yehuda is coming to be machmir, and he's obligating the chenvani like any other mocher to do shalosh tipin, except for the exception of Erev Shabbos Sanya. The brisa says, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Erev Shabbos im chashecha, chenvani potur, mitnei shechenvani tarud. It means that Rabbi Yehuda is talking about a chenvani explicitly, and he's telling you that in the case of the Chenvani, only on Erev Shabbos were we lenient. So the Tanakhama exempts the Chenvani at all times, whereas Rabbi Yehuda exempts the Chenvani only at dusk on Erev Shabbos. Then the Mishnah goes on and describes a case of a Chenvani. The next Mishnah, I should say, goes on and again gets back to the Chenvani. And in this case, he sends a katan, a minor, right? He's less than bar mitzvah, with a barrel of oil, right? A barrel of oil to be sold on the market. Now, I don't know if that was a good idea. You know, you sell a child, you send a child, you know, with expensive oil, or alternatively, he sent him with money to buy oil, right? Because he's a buyer and a seller. Is the Mishnah establishes Hasholeach es bino. Again, the Rashbam adds that the ben is a katan, not just tam a ben. A ben could be a 15-year-old. Now, here's the young boy, Eitzel Chenvani. Okay, now here's an interesting case. Okay, we'll get to the case of the Chenvani who sends a katan, but now we have the first we have the case where the buyer who's buying from the Chenvani sends his own son. Now, was the Chenvani smart when he poured the oil into the barrel of the buyer, who's being represented now? The buyer's nowhere to be seen by his son, who's a katan. Eitzel Chenvani, ufujon biyado. And now he receives payment, and he's being told to make this purchase. So the Mishnah says, madad lo beiser shemen. He poured out a certain amount of a volume of oil, v'nasan lo, and the chenvani gave over to this katan isar, in other words, the payment for this. So in this case, the chenvani is buying, again, he's buying in order to sell. Ishaves atzluchis, now this young child broke the barrel of oil, and all the oil spilled out. V'ibed es ha'isur, and he lost the change, the money that was meant to be paid by the chenvani to the seller. Is chenvani chayav? The chenvani in this case is considered a mazik, meaning he had no right to do this and put the oil into the hands of the katan. He should have anticipated that a katan is not reliable, he's not mature enough to do the proper shmira and protect it. He's also he's also taken a loss on the isar, on the coins that he sent with this katan, because he shouldn't have done such a thing. Rabbi Yehuda poter shalmanas ken shlocho. Rabbi Yehuda says that the chenvani is exempt from paying damages here, because since the seller sent his own child to the chenvani, and the condition almanas was that the chenvani would pass on the shemen and the isar over to the katan, therefore the seller has exempt the chenvani from any level of responsibility. Why? Because he deliberately sent his child. Umodim chachamim l'Rabbi Yehuda bizman shatzluchis biyad atinok umodad chenvani l'socha shechenvani patur. But in the case where the chenvani did not take this receptacle into his hands, but rather the receptacle remained in the hands of the tinok, and therefore the medida, the measuring of the oil, was done by the chenvani l'socha, shechenvani patur. In that case, even the chacham will agree that the chenvani is patur. Okay, Rabbi Moshe, we'll stop here. We covered most of what we had on schedule for today, and the Mitzvah Shem will be able to pick this up tomorrow. Let's make a quick review, Bezer Hashem, of the Mishnah, the new Mishnah that we're doing here on Pezayin Amud Beis. And the Mishnah says that a person sends a child, his own son, to a chenvani to buy oil, and he sends money with the child. The chenvani measured out an isur's worth of shemen, and the child gave the isur, and that was his change from the pudjon. Now, on the way home, the child broke the tzluchis, this receptacle, the ibed esa isur, and he lost the change that he was bringing back to his father. Is chenvani chayev? In this case, the storekeeper has to pay damages. What means he's going to have to compensate the father of the child for the oil and the iser, and of course the flask itself. Rabbi Yehuda poter. Rabbi Yehuda says that al menas kein shilcho, that since the child was sent by the buyer intentionally, what he meant to do was he meant to send a message clearly to the chenvani that the chenvani should give the child the oil, and also give him back the change, you know, the isur, that's the change from the punjan. Therefore, the chenvani is alleviated of any responsibility. He doesn't have to compensate the father at all. The chachamim agree to Rabbi Yehuda that there is a case in which Rabbi Yehuda is right and the chenvani is patur, and that's bizman shatzluchis biyad hatinok. In other words, if this utensil, this receptacle, we'll call it a flask, was in the hands of the child, umadad chenvani l'socha, and the storekeeper measured out the oil into the tzluchis, which was in the hands of the child, chenvani patur. In this case, he's alleviated of any liability, of any responsibility to compensate the father, the buyer, and the reason why he's freed of any liability, says the Rashbam, is because since the tzluchis itself was in the hands of the child and the tzluchis broke, then the chenvani does not have to pay for the breaking of the tzluchis. Again, all this we'll see in the Sugis HaGemara. And the Gemara is going to have a suffix here about... And that lies at the heart of the machlokas between Rabbi Yehuda and Chachamim, that the Rabbanan of the opinion that laduye shadre, whereas Rabbi Yehuda is of the opinion lishadure le shadre, and that machlokas will be analyzed by the Gemara itself. But when the Chachamim amod at the end of the Mishnah to Rabbi Yehuda, alleviating the chenvani of his liability, of his responsibility, that's only vis-a-vis the tzluchis itself. He still remains a mazik, or shall we say a poshea, because his negligence was responsible for the loss of the oil and the isar. And the reason for that is because the Rabbanan hold le'oduye shadre, that the only reason the father was sending his child was not because he wanted the child to bring home the oil, but rather he wanted to notify the storekeeper that he's interested, the father, the buyer, in this deal. But Rabbi Yehuda's of the opinion that l'shadure le'shadre, that it was the intention of the father, l'shadure, that the chenvani would send him back the oil, receive the payment for the oil. Elitzluchis, but with regard to the flask itself, that the Gemara is going to analyze under the halacha of Aveda Midas, and Emirtz Hashem, we'll see that the Hemshech.